Hey everyone, welcome to Entrepreneurship by Design with Dr. C. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline, and thank you so much for joining us today. Entrepreneurship looks different for everyone. How and why we start our business, challenges that occur, pivots we have to make, success we achieve, all while life is happening. That's why I love sharing these inspiring entrepreneurs with you and shed light that there's enough room for everyone to succeed and thrive, even if you're in the same industry. So glad you're here with us today because we have an incredible guest with us, Christopher Dabbing. Christopher is an experienced entrepreneur who has founded and grown a business from an idea and laptop to an international eight-figure revenue business. As the founder of Cambridge Mass Co., he led the charge in protecting over 1 million customers across 120 countries since its establishment in 2015. Christopher went on to found Cambridge Sewing Co., which produces top quality apparel through contract manufacturing. Now, Christopher is expanding his business ventures further with the launch of Kita Support. This customer service solution provider aims to deliver the ultimate customer experience through human-centric outsourcing. Christopher's vision, leadership, and passion for excellence has made him a valuable contributor to many media outlets, having conducted interviews live on Bloomberg News, BBC Radio, and gave a speech at the United Nations. Thank you so much, Christopher, for being here today. It is such a pleasure to have you. And I would love for you to just dive into your journey, how you got here today, and then we can go a little deeper.
Well, it's great to be with you. My name is Chris Dobbing, the founder and CEO of Kita.Support. We help small and medium-sized businesses with their live chat, phone support, and social media to make sure their customers are feeling loved and looked after.
I love it. And it's such an amazing aspect of what you do. And how did you get here today? What did that process look like for you?
Well, to go backwards, the business is essentially a spin out from our main company. So I moved to China in 2012, soon after graduating. Ended up working in education, but the air pollution there can be really serious. And, you know, I don't believe any child should grow up thinking it's normal to cough all day or carry an inhaler around with them. So I ended up kind of working in the air pollution space, started getting into masks and developing a company called Cambridge Mask Co. So that had a lot of kind of investors from around Cambridge University. We used a lot of British technology, ended up getting the rights to a British military filter technology that worked really well for filtering air pollution. As it turned out, that also filters viruses very well. So once COVID hit, it was very much in demand and we were able to grow the business quite substantially through COVID. And now coming out of that, we're looking to diversify the business a little bit. We've got a really rugged customer service team that have, you know, dealt with some customers with very high expectations, very high demands. So because they've been through that, they can really understand from a customer's perspective that they need to be treated well, respected, understood, and kind of responded to in a timely manner. So we're trying to take those lessons from selling an incredibly important life and death, in some cases, product for some people, yeah, and taking the experiences from selling that at scale over to help other people with their companies and make sure that their customer service interactions are working well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's phenomenal what you've been able to create and how many people you are helping and how it started as a little seed and has grown so significantly, especially with COVID and just really helping people. And can you share a story of how you took this idea, turned it into an international eight-figure revenue business with Cambridge Mass Co., and what were some of those key challenges or milestones along the way?
Well, the first part with a product company is finding factories and suppliers. That took about 9 months to source 14 different factories for all the different components and bits. So I was flying all over China as well as meeting people in the UK to get the filters sorted out, which is the most important part. But there's a lot of other bits of packaging, labels, just all the little bits and pieces that go into any product. So all of those, you want to go meet the factory, get to know the factory team, see that it's actually the factory you're dealing with and not some middleman or agent, check that all their labor practices are in order. So there's a lot of work to do in that. But once you can meet the minimum order quantities, and usually if you meet them in person, you can try and kind of bring those down a little bit and they're a little bit more sympathetic to small companies. But once you can do that, you've got a product to sell and you can kind of move on from there and start taking on the challenge of either direct customer sales, or we actually started out with B2B. So we had some initial funding, which I raised from angel investors who knew me through my university connections with Cambridge University, and also a few people who are based in Asia. Used that to meet the MOQs and get a product developed, and then using the contacts I'd actually made in the education space from my main job, I was able to get kind of points of access into the big international schools in China, as well as the big international hospitals. And I actually, you know, people talk about the elevator pitch, but I actually ended up in an elevator with the CEO of like the hospital group that I was So I literally walked out of the purchase office, having just pitched them and had a kind of like, yeah, interesting, we'll look at it, to meeting the CEO. And she gave me her business card, and then I could email the procurement team and be like, yeah, I just spoke to the CEO, she likes it, and that helped me get the deal. So I managed to get the elevator pitch perfect, and that really won me like a very large contract. So that was super exciting.
That's amazing. And I love that it was truly an elevator pitch.
It was literally, yeah, we just rode down together. I probably had 2 or 3 minute conversation, but it was enough for me to impress her enough to get a business card. And then I could kind of CC her in the email, and it really helped push the procurement team.
And it's taking risks, right? Taking opportunities when they are presented, and because you never know what can happen if you just got to talk about it. And so I know you mentioned funding too, but how did you navigate the process of expanding your business ventures from Cambridge Mass Co to founding Cambridge Sewing Company? And what were the lessons you learned in expanding into the apparel industry?
So we've got Kita.support, which is the customer service side. And then we actually ended up building our own production facilities in Indonesia, because the trade war with China has created a lot of friction and a lot of trade barriers. We have about 40% of our customers are based in the US. So that's for the mask side. So that's generally people with asthma, emphysema, respiratory diseases, worried about air pollution, worried about viral protection. So there's quite a big kind of community of people. And the import duties from China to the US went up to, I think, 28% because of the trade war. From Indonesia, it was only 7%. So the delta, or like the difference on what we were paying in import duties, actually nearly covered the cost of like developing the factory and building our own production facility. So in May 2019, we made that decision to move production over to Indonesia. Rented out the big factory, like an empty factory space, built the factory inside that, or production facility, and built that up. Now that production has kind of settled back down a little bit post-COVID, we've got spare capacity. The factory is audited and certified to like a really high standard, because masks are, you know, obviously kind of really important that they're done well and that they're held to a very high standard. So because of the certifications we've had to go through, the productions to a really, really high level. And that means we can offer a really, really amazing level of service and support for people that want to do garment, textile, or apparel based products. So we've been speaking to a number of different parties over the last kind of year, worked with people doing all kinds of broad range of different products, but really anything that requires sewing machines and all the equipment that goes around that, we have it all. And we've got a really amazing team of staff there as well. As far as Indonesia goes, a lot of people have been moving out of China into kind of Indonesia and other surrounding countries and rejigging supply chains. The demographics for Indonesia are fascinating, because there's 270 million people there and half of them are under 30. So, you know, there's just this enormous pool of talent, loads of really, really hardworking, like amazing level of English, really great work ethic. And China has a lot of benefits, you know, really good supply chains, but the demographics, people are aging very, very quickly. The labor price inflation is very high. So actually we found Indonesia works really well for us.
Interesting. I just learned something very new. I did not know that, but that's a big number. But I can see how the aging aspect of population in China versus Indonesia, and how I didn't realize 217 million, if I heard that correctly, of under 30.
Well, half of them are under 30.
Oh, under, yeah. So that's a significant amount of people.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. So that they've got this huge demographic dividend just moving through at the moment. So for the next 20, 30 years, there's going to be a really great kind of pool of labor available in Indonesia. Whereas in China, people have been aging rapidly, and that they're kind of at the tail end of that process. But as the entrepreneur, you have to kind of have an eye on these big figures, and the global politics and trade wars and things can really affect you, even especially as a small business. I feel like as a big company, you can kind of screw up again and again and again, and you get more and more chances because you can just recover if you're bigger. But if you're a really small business, you know, one screw up, even if it's not your fault, like it's still your problem. And often it just means that it's there, you know, you either have to adapt or die.
That's true. It puts it in perspective, because I do believe that, like, with the bigger companies, there's more people, there's more ways to figure it out or put money towards something, versus if you're a smaller business, it could be the end of your business if you don't do it the right way.
Just some small change in trade policy for tariff codes or whatever, and it can have a huge impact.
Putting it in a different lens. And so I know customer service is such a big key of what you do and the industry you're in as well. And with the launch of Kidda Support, what inspired you to enter the customer service solutions industry? And how do you envision the ultimate customer service experience through human-centric outsourcing?
Well, our outsourcing model is based on putting the customer right at the center of what people do, particularly looking after existing customers. So I remember reading, I think it was in the Harvard Business Review, a really interesting report looking at Buick cars. And their marketing team looked at their data and realized that once you buy one Buick, you'll probably buy another and another and another, and people are really brand loyal. So they stopped kind of marketing to top of funnel people that didn't know the brand, and really marketing and looking after the existing customers and focusing on those. And the lifetime average value of those customers just went up massively, and it really like built a solid base for the brand. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies will spend, you know, $5, $6, sometimes even $20, $30 bringing in a new customer, and then maybe won't spend $1, $2, $3 on customer service support to look after that customer and keep them happy, which we find really frustrating, because it's, you know, we charge per ticket, like it's just a couple of dollars per ticket. So it's a very, very easy to see what your cost will be. It completely scales with your demands and your needs. So we keep it really, really flexible, and it's, you know, in most cases, less than the cost of having someone click and come through to your website from a search engine. So it's a very, very cost-effective way. And if you can really invest in your customers and make sure that the lifetime value that they're bringing your company is higher, that often, you know, covers the cost by many multiples.
That makes a lot of sense. And what do you believe separates good customer service from great customer service?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think in customer service in general, across services and products, my definition of five-star service is getting things you didn't realize you wanted. So there's a lot of things that you go way above the expectations. If you're in a five-star hotel, like the definition of the amazing service is just someone's done a small thing in your room. Like if you, like my daughter's 6 years old, they've left a child-sized dressing gown or something in your room, and you didn't realize that was something that you wanted, but suddenly it's like, you know, really, really cool, and she's happy, and it's like, oh wow. And it was just one of, you know, some tiny little thing, doesn't cost them a lot of money, but it's just the thought and the extra effort. And if you can do that with a product where someone's complained about a size being wrong, and you go, oh well, we've just sent you two of like the two different sizes either side for free, here you go, it really surprises people. So it's being timely with your responses and making sure you're coming back to people quickly. That's not optional now. I think it's like absolutely mandatory for customer service, but also going beyond what people's expectations are. And with e-commerce evolving so fast and there's expectations people have going up and up, it is getting harder and harder to stay ahead of those expectations and deliver great service. But a lot of companies are unfortunately very bad at customer service. Sometimes it's easier for small businesses, but we do find a staggering number of small companies still have the CEO, founder, doing customer service for a couple of hours every morning. And it's important to look after your customers, but that's often a really bad use of time. I'm a member of Entrepreneurs Organization, or EO, so a global group that's been absolutely amazing. I'm really, really proud to be a member, and I find my forum really useful. But you know, the mantra of that is work on your business, not in your business. So stepping back, looking at the ecosystem of like the business that you've built, how it operates, and trying to tinker with it rather than being right at the center and being the bottleneck that's making things work. So by outsourcing and using partners, you're able to do that. You can step back, set up the system, and then you're spending your time making sure that system is working and that your customers are still really happy, even without you being involved. And that way you're generating time for yourself, which is of course the most valuable commodity you've got, but also increasing value in your company, because you know people don't want to buy a business when you come to sell it that requires you to be there. If you can step back and the business is still profitable and making money and you're not involved, that's amazing. And that's going to add value.
No, it adds so much value. And I think it's such a key aspect of what you said, work in your business versus on your business, and how that can be really differentiated between the two. And like you mentioned, the CEO working a few hours in the morning on customer service, but not really tending to their business too. And that can really disable the aspect of not being able to really focus in on what your vision is and how you're moving forward and taking those action steps and utilizing your time where it's going to be better served for the overall good for yourself, the business, and all the people around you as well, your family. And just as a leader in your industry, what role has vision played in your success? How do you continue to cultivate and communicate your vision to your team and also your stakeholders?
Well, vision and mission have been really central to what we do. You know, it's probably no exaggeration to say there are people alive today who wouldn't be without the product we've developed. So I take a lot of pride in that, particularly the families we've helped. And we've had emails through from people whose children have leukemia and other diseases saying what an important role Cambridge Mass Co plays in their lives. And that's always so deeply motivating and humbling to get those kind of messages. We've now sold to more than 1 million customers in over 120 countries. So, you know, it's really something that has touched lives all over the world, which is something I can be really proud of. But for Key to Support as well, just taking the lessons we've had from that journey and helping other business owners, I really enjoy coming in, learning businesses, learning new products, and making sure that we really understand the product and the business first before we then go out and deal with people's customers. And, you know, often people have spent thousands of dollars getting to on marketing to get to the point where customers are coming in the door or they bought the product. So it requires a lot of trust to hand those customers over to another party. So, you know, I often meet with the CEOs of the company, build up that relationship, and then they can trust us and know that we're going to look after their customers as if they were our own. And for Cambridge Sewing Company on the manufacturing side, the complexities of all the different components and parts that go into manufacturing a product. Again, I've sourced that myself. I've flown around. I've been in over 100 factories in my life. I know a good factory from a bad one. I know how to source things. So, you know, I've got a lot of experience with that process, and I feel the pain. I understand how hard it can be for people to get that right. And as a product business, you're only as good as your manufacturing partners, for one. And secondly, you're only as fast as your slowest component when you're trying to produce things. So with those two facts kind of well learned by us, you know, we can help again guide people through that journey.
Yes, absolutely. And that's part of that process, right? Because all the lessons you've learned, but being able to build that trust, build that relationship with the CEOs to know that they have their customers are in good hands moving forward as well. And that's a huge part of it. And, you know, I know you do a lot of other things as well. I know you conduct interviews on major media outlets. And with your experience conducting interviews on different media sources and outlets, how has sharing your expertise and insights shaped your entrepreneurial journey? What has the impact been on your business and your personal brand?
Well, I think certainly doing live to air interviews with Bloomberg was a really scary one. I enjoyed the challenge, but I don't know how many million people it was being broadcast to at the time that I did it, but it was a lot. And, you know, you have zero margin for error, that unlike this, which is thankfully being recorded, so we can always edit if something does go wrong. When you're live to air, that's it. There's no chance for a retake. So you've got to get it perfect. I've done interviews with BBC and a couple of other major kind of broadcasters on radio in the UK and kind of globally, but not the kind of filmed ones as I did with Bloomberg to air. So that was a big first step for me. And we've been really lucky with our public relations over the years. We've been covered in a lot of media. And when you're trying to build your search engine optimization and train the search engines to kind of find your website and boost you in search results, a really reputable media organization writing about you and your company will lift your page up really, really well. So the energy, you know, it takes a lot of energy and time to reach out to journalists and do the PR. And generally, I would always encourage people to do PR themselves, not use PR agencies. At least in my personal experience, it's always been much more effective to reach out yourself to journalists rather than hiring someone else to do it, because you're always going to sound more genuine if it's your business. Right. That, again, that's just my experience.
Yeah.
But through doing that and through kind of building up the relationships I have with journalists and media, we have that played a really big part in laying the groundwork for when COVID did come. You know, we'd spent the previous 3, 4, 5 years building up that online presence, and 18%, 1/8 of our page traffic from 2020 came from one blog post that had been cited by a couple of different media organizations. So, you know, the seed that we planted in the ground years before that we'd pretty much forgotten about suddenly just became this huge thing for us and brought in at least 6 figures for us just from that one blog post.
That's incredible. And, you know, I'm glad you talked about the PR aspect, because a lot of people, I get approached a lot of, oh, I can help you with your PR or media outlets and things along those lines. But I think there is something so beautiful about just that connection piece of you reaching out and the genuineness you're talking about. Not to say somebody's not, if they are using that, but there's just more of this energy around it, I would say, where you
are. There's a self-imposed filter if you put someone
else. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, just even the work that you have done, I know you have spoken a lot of places, but in particular, I know you gave a speech at the United Nations. Could you tell us about your experience and what the topic was of that speech? And what did it mean to you to have that opportunity to share that message?
Well, speaking at the UN was, again, a massive career highlight. So I was really, really proud to be able to address, I think it was 60 ambassadors, along with the Secretary General of the World Health Organization, who was actually speaking just before me. So, you know, no pressure. as well as the British ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva. So it was a really, really special time. We were doing a project with the British Embassy on antimicrobial resistance. And of course, masks play a really important part of that, like protecting people. But antibiotics are starting to become less effective, and a lot of pharmaceutical companies aren't investing in new research that would bring new antibiotics to market. So we face the very real prospect in the next 10 or 20 years that antibiotics stop working, and then you've got really, really serious problems. So masks are one way to help reduce infection rates in the first place, but also just the importance of people not overprescribing antibiotics. And I think it's about 2/3 of antibiotics are actually used in the food chain. So they just give antibiotics to animals to stop them getting sick, because they're all cramped together often and in not great conditions. And they just call it growth hormone or growth promoter. But actually, it's just antibiotics. And the overuse of that is causing enormous problems. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But it was a huge privilege to get to go to the UN and kind of talk about that and highlight the issue. So really enjoyable.
Yes. And I think it's so important to be able to talk about those things, because it's not talked about enough, or being able to have a different perspective on it, because maybe it has been talked about, but to the level of the UN and being able to reach so many people and having a message that you're so passionate about too, but that is making a difference of talking about it and bringing it to people's awareness and acknowledging it as well. I think that's a key part too. And so just even with everything that you're passionate about, everything that you do, how do you maintain your passion for excellence in your entrepreneurial journey? What like strategies or practices do you employ to stay motivated?
Well, obviously there's always tough times running your own company, and sometimes they're really tough and it can get quite dark. And I would say EO has always been the kind of light at the end of the tunnel to help me guide through that. In EO, you're not allowed to tell people what they should do or make suggestions. You can only share your personal experience. But it's a great leveler. It means that you kind of, everyone's on the same level. It doesn't create this disparity between fellow members. And so that's always been a really helpful resource and tool to give the kind of inputs you need to work your problems out yourself. So I've always found that really helpful. And secondly, I think the joy I take has been on building up my team and helping people learn and grow. So we've had a lot of our staff in Indonesia who literally grew up in like villages with no, you know, with mud floors. And now they come and started working with us, maybe in a junior position. And we've had some female members of staff who've been able to kind of work their way up in the company. And we had one in particular who was, you know, really, really quiet, like introverted, And now she's blossomed into this incredible manager. She ended up managing a team of 30 people. Her salary is like supporting her entire extended family network. And being able to kind of provide those opportunities for people is really special. And also just being able to train them up and give them the career progression they wouldn't probably get with a local company. Like, although Indonesia has a lot of great points, you know, particularly for women's entrepreneurship and women's management, there aren't often as many opportunities. So, you know, that's been a real privilege.
And I think too, it's so amazing what you've been able to accomplish, but also so many opportunities that are being created every day for individuals, just like you mentioned, this individual and helping her, but also her family and being able to blossom into the person she's going to be and continue to grow and evolve. And that's the beautiful thing when we have those aspects and spaces for us to really thrive in, we're able to grow into it if we're given that opportunity. And that's what you're doing for people. And what advice would you give aspiring entrepreneurs who are just starting on their business journeys? What are the key principles or lessons you would encourage them to embrace?
Well, we were lucky enough to get into the Y Combinator Fellowship Program way back in 2016. So it feels like a very long time ago. But those kind of founding principles are still very apt, which is build something people want and kind of early stage do things that don't scale. So calling up every single customer who's bought from your website by phone and like grilling them for 10 minutes, like, why did you buy it? What do you think of it? Like, what other brands did you look at? Da, 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 da. Just getting a really good feel. And it's better to get 100 customers that love your brand than 1,000 that think it's okay. You know, you just need to find those kernel of like really enthusiastic people who love what you're doing, and they'll be your best ambassadors. You know, the power of word of mouth and getting all the references from them, always just has a huge, huge impact. So early days, it's finding those kind of first 100 customers that love you. That's the really hard bit. And then that's kind of the journey towards product market fit. And also just staying very iterative. You know, we've changed the product every couple of months. We try and modify and change and improve and make sure that we're not just selling the same thing over and over again, because customers change and their expectations change, as we've discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's moving with the market as well, but also staying loyal to your brand and allowing room for growth. It's like spring. And so what are some of the tools that you use to build your business, that especially a product-based business? Because we don't really talk a lot about product-based businesses here. Obviously, customer service is a little different too, but what are some of the main tools that you've used to build your business when it comes to tech, software, anything along those lines?
For manufacturing business, we use a New Zealand-based company called Cin7, C-I-N, and then the number 7. That's been great as an enterprise resource planning software. It's slightly more on the expensive side, but has definitely paid its own costs many times over with just helping manage all of that side of things. On the accounting, it's standard things like Xero, that's been really great. Klaviyo for email marketing. So again, all the standard things, really. And we've always used Teams, I think, for the last few years. Microsoft have made their products much, much better in the last few years. They've all improved massively. And I think Teams was a great innovation. So we found that really useful.
Definitely really good tips and tools as well that we can use to utilize when it comes to manufacturing or any kind of business, especially Teams. I do agree it has changed. And how do you approach the balance between innovation and practicability in your business venture? So how do you identify new opportunities while ensuring stability and growth in your business?
Again, I think it comes back to listening to your customer. They'll tell you what they want in many cases. And of course, there's the Steve Jobs role, as in like inventing an iPad because no one ever asked for one. Is the Henry Ford thing. If you ask people what they want, they'll ask for a faster horse and then you invent the car. So there are these big leapfrogs, but 95% of the innovation is really just listening to customers and improving. And if you read, I'd say Shoe Dog, the book about the founder of Nike, Phil Knight, brilliant book. And there's a really great example there of just constantly listening to your customers and iterating and improving. And they, you know, he's there at track meets, like getting the feedback from people, going back to the factory, just constantly iterating and improving till you've got the best shoe on the market. And equally, whatever your product or service might be, just constantly listening and getting those improvements and iterating. When customers find something they like, they'll let you know about it. So, you know, that's definitely the way to go forward.
Well, that's really good to know too. And I know you are a father, and how has it been integrating entrepreneurship and fatherhood and just life in general?
I mean, I was a dad relatively young by Western standards, although not so much living in China. But I've found actually having family has helped center me really well. And often as an entrepreneur, you get really dragged into work. It's very easy to want to spend 17, 18 hours a day working and just like hacking away at your business. But with kind of wife and kids, like your child doesn't care that, you know, it's end of month payroll time. They want you to play with them before bed and you kind of have to. So I find actually it really centers you being forced to kind of eat the standard three meals a day and have a proper bedtime. And if you're going to do this marathon of running your own business rather than a sprint, it's definitely more effective way of not burning yourself out really quickly. So I found actually the family has helped enormously in balancing things out and making sure you're splitting your time between family and work and getting that harmony.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up too, it is a marathon. It is not a sprint if you're in it for the long haul. I mean, you can have a quick business and it can fail very quickly too. But if you're in it for the long run, just knowing that it is a marathon and taking that time to really foster those relationships in business, but also outside of business, your family comes up. I always think family comes first, but also business. It's a hard balance sometimes. But I so appreciate everything you shared with us, Christopher. Where can people find you, use your services? We're going to link everything below, but if you could let us know too.
Great. So it's keta.support for customer service. CambridgeMask.com for masks if anyone needs them, and Cambridge Sew & Co. for production services in Asia for outsourced manufacturing.
Well, thank you so much again, Christopher, for sharing all your insights, all your wisdom, and everything you're doing to really help the world in so many different aspects and industries. But thank you again for coming on and just being here today.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Make sure to like, subscribe, comment below. What was your biggest takeaway from Christopher today? I'm sure he would love to see that comment, and we'll see you on the next episode.